Okay. I think the tape is on now, so we might as well get going. My name is Jody Kretzmann, and we're going to do a series of things this week that I'm calling Social Justice in the City. I feel a little bit like the vegetarian alternative that's sometimes announced at lunch. I'm sort of the secular alternative to theological heavies this week. And it would be treating the city, although from some sorts of ethical points of view at various points, I think I really want to do it from my own viewpoint as a social scientist and as a political and social activist that mainly works in city scenes. The goal, I think, that I've got this week in the sessions that I'll be doing is simply to share my own view of some of the major trends that I see happening in American cities, some of the problems that are emerging year by year, and a few of the promises that are emerging as well, and what to explore then with the rest of you, what relationships we might have to all of that, and in fact, what contributions we might have to solutions of any of the problems that are emerging in the city, and particularly, what are the demands and dimensions of the questions of social justice as they emerge in the city. I think I'll try to do this with a pretty broad brush, so that people whose disciplines are not the city can follow and enter into conversation as we go along. So I'll really concentrate, I think, on overall trends. Hopefully, for those of you who know a lot about cities, I'll be able to pull some stuff together into categories that make sense and that are sort of easy to deal with, be able to help those of you who are expert out in that way, and for those of you who don't deal with cities very much, maybe introduce a few new dimensions of city life and ways of thinking about cities to you too. The way I've organized four sessions this week is to deal first with economic life, and then political life, and social and cultural life, and finally with signs of hope of some kind. That's sort of arbitrary. That's an arbitrary way of dealing with the city. In our own teaching and urban studies program, where Ingrid and I operate most of the time, we take it as a matter of faith that the city does not come in these easy disciplinary categories. It doesn't come like a college textbook. It comes as a kind of whole. It comes as a kind of seamless reality. It comes as a reality in which all of these elements are totally interrelated. But I think that probably for purposes of developing a language, it does make some sense to separate out the categories and deal more or less with economic categories today, lay economic categories, I won't get quantitative on you, and more or less with politics and social and cultural life in the next couple of sessions. Just a couple of things to help you locate me in your own categories, in a matter of sort of confessional statement of where I am. I've spent most of the last 20 years teaching about and studying about and writing about and acting about cities, most particularly Chicago. And I guess I have become and still become, week by week, more and more aware of how vast and various the topic of cities is. It's a virtually overwhelming field because it contains within it all of the variety of disciplines. So let me make a couple of caveats and let you know about what my limitations are, which are many. I'm certainly talking this week fundamentally about United States cities. I know something about, have done some work on cities in other parts of the world, but I certainly know most about United States cities. But we can do some talking about comparisons. And to some degree, I'm going to concentrate on, as my sort of archetype, the major type of city, on the older industrial cities of the Midwest and Northeast. I know most about them. I've worked most in them. In the Frost Belt cities. I know a little bit about the Sun Belt cities and about the Northwest, but one of the things that I would really look forward to from those of you who are from this part of the world and from the South and Sunbelt cities is some dialogue about the differences between the two types of cities, the so-called Frost Belt and the so-called Sunbelt cities. I'm going to at least base the introductions to these various topics, though, on what I know best, which is the Sunbelt city reality. I guess the third thing I should say confessionally is that I am unabashedly a lover of cities. I just dig them. Holden is nice, but I don't think I can take this for more than 10 weeks ever in my life. I think my family sort of feels the same way. I love the diversity of cities. I love their pace, even, although one's psychological health depends on getting away from it occasionally. I love the sense of excitement. I love the sort of cacophony of voices that one has in the city. I love virtually everything about them, I guess. And I think that they are undervalued by a lot of what is most common in mainstream American culture. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit, about why it is that so many people sort of have an avoidance reaction to cities. And the last thing I want to say sort of as a confessional or as a background thing before I get into the economics is that I thought very seriously about how to treat one particular aspect of city life, and that is race. Race is going to be central to the discussions that I'll be doing throughout the week, but I've decided not to encapsulate it in one particular session, rather to talk about racial dimensions of economic life and political life and social and cultural life as we go through the week. But just to let you know that is going to be absolutely central to some discussions that we'll be doing throughout the week. Okay, let me just say about 15 or 20 minutes of stuff, an introduction to the economics of city life, and then hopefully we can get into some discussion ourselves. Let me warn you that if there's a pattern to this, in my own thinking, to this setup of topics, it is that the economic life of cities seems to me to be the major problematic that we're presented with. That is, understanding the major dimensions of economic activity in the city today means for me understanding the major sources of the problems of cities today. All right. So it could be that today is going to be more of a downer than the other 2 days. In my view, the resources for change, the resources for activity in service of social justice, for instance, are to be found both within the political life and the social and cultural life, as well as some other things that we'll delineate later on in the week. So just to warn you, the economic life of the city, it seems to me at this point, that is the lens through which most clearly the problems of city life, and in fact maybe of overall American culture, can be viewed. Okay, I want to acknowledge too that there's a real sense, even at Holden Village, in which the whole of our lives is now urban, right? None of us are non-urban people anymore. The sense in which the technology that makes possible the global village, which though it's still centered in cities per se, reaches out and takes us all in, makes us in fact all urban. We are plugged in technologically to the major command and control and communication centers of our modern cities. The media are urban. Our major service industries are urban. And virtually all of our lives are in some ways, even at Holden Village, closely connected with urban realities. And this is probably more true of economic life than it is of political or social-cultural life. Because again, even at Holden, all you have to do is read the labels on the stuff that comes into the kitchen, or on any of the hardware apparatus around this village to know that we are totally plugged in to industrial, automated, urban-centered processes of production. Nonetheless, even though we are plugged into a global and urban economy, what I want to do is to talk about urban in the sense of the space that is a city, not urban in the sense of the broadly encompassing kind of realities that we're all a part of. Those are two different ways to talk about urban. We could talk about urban as something that we're all in all the time, and that would be fun to talk about, and I think we, you know, if you want to do that, we can do that. But I want to talk particularly about the pieces of space that are cities. Okay. And the economic life of those places themselves. I think it's real important, if we're going to understand the cities, to know a little bit about the history. So let me do a little brief economic history for you, because you can see the economic history of cities when you see cities, right? Let me oversimplify entirely and talk about three major stages that at least the older Midwestern and Eastern cities of the United States have gone through. To some degree, cities like San Francisco have also undergone these three stages, and you could see it physically, spatially, laid out in a few West Coast cities as well, with some longer histories to them. But mainly I'll be talking here about the Northeast and Midwest. When you walk through a city, you're walking through history. You're walking through space that has been shaped by particularly the economic activity, the organization of economic activity in the past. And then a new stage of economic activity has come along and overlaid on that same space the new economic activity. That's happened basically three times in our oldest cities. Our oldest cities started out as mercantile cities, right? When you think about Boston and New York, people have traveled through the eastern cities, Boston, New York, Philadelphia particularly. From the earliest stages on, what we've got there are cities where trade is central, where the harbor cities on the East Coast are set up mainly as places where people can trade goods with each other. When you think about New York, Philadelphia, Boston, also Chicago, St. Louis, and to some degree Minneapolis, and certainly also San Francisco, all have a hinterland, all have an outlying area from which they did draw, raw materials, agricultural products, wood products. They get shipped to the major cities, and they get either shipped through them or traded there. So that when you look at those older cities, you see that the key initial geographic consideration for their location and the way they're laid out is the development of water and then land transportation, right? Almost all of those older cities grow up along water transport kinds of avenues. We're talking here about the beginning of colonial America to about the late 19th century, the growth of the mercantile cities. When you think about the way economic life was organized in those years, you can identify a series of social justice questions that deal with the economic life of those cities. We won't obviously be dealing with those today, but the question of slavery is a question of justice having to do with mercantile cities, not with industrial cities or any of the later stages. The question of the relationship of servant to master and the way in which wages get defined is a question of justice and economic life that's related to the mercantile stage of cities. Finally, it seems to me the question of the openness of entrepreneurial activity. Can people get into business, get into trade themselves? How open is that? Was a question of economic justice for that period of time. By the late 19th century, and here we're getting very current too, because we're still in this stage to some degree, often overlaid on top of the mercantile city, straight over it, we get the growth of the industrial city. And in fact, all of the cities from Minneapolis back east in the Snow Belt are fundamentally, geographically, spatially, industrial cities. That's what they were made to be. In the older ones where the mercantile stage had some kind of real impetus to it, and had really had an effect on how those cities look, you can still see some really strong signs that they were harbor cities, that they were trade cities. But the industrial city basically just overwhelmed the mercantile city, and it led to the huge growth of American cities, as it did of European cities too. Now, in this stage from the late 19th century to the present, but really strongly to 1950, the major function, the major economic function of cities is manufacturing, right? Now raw materials are brought to the city, but they're not necessarily traded. Something is done to them there. Some kind of industrial operation takes raw materials and makes them something else. In the Northeast, it's primarily textiles and shoes. In the Midwest, it's steel and metal and foodstuffs of various kinds. Foodstuffs, in fact, everywhere. From the late 19th century on, the landscape of urban America gets dominated by huge factories, right? And the scale gets bigger and bigger. The look and feel of those older cities is dominated by those huge factories. Often along transportation routes, often in fact overwhelming the routes that the mercantile city was built on. In that stage, the questions of economic justice, in the industrial city stage, the questions of economic justice are primarily the questions having to do with the formation of the working class and the organization of the working class. That is, their wages and hours and working conditions for the emerging industrial working class, what we now call the blue-collar kind of class. And they are, these economic justice issues, primarily issues of the ability of the working class to organize itself as a negotiating power in the marketplace, in the place where jobs and wages are negotiated. Contrast to the earlier stage in the mercantile city, where the question is slavery, where the question is the openness of entrepreneurial opportunities. Now it really is the question of economic justice, is the question of whether or not the working class will be able to organize around wages and working conditions. That brings us to 1950. For the last 25 or 30 years at least, easily the major thing that has been going on in American cities is something I'm sure you're all familiar with, which has been, I suppose, most often labeled deindustrialization, the deindustrialization of American cities. Very simply, the industrial city has entered into a steep and really increasingly precipitous decline. And it's a very complicated kind of decline. Let's just say a couple of things about it, about what's happened here. Clearly, what we've seen is massive changes in both the technology and the organization of work and labor, and therefore in the shape of our cities. In short, in many industries, fewer people can produce more stuff, right? So that the number of folks that are employed in the manufacturing sector that actually make things every year goes down. In other industries where lots of particularly lower skilled workers are still needed, the manufacturing operations themselves have become more mobile, right? So that the operations themselves follow the pool of unskilled labor to the point where it is lowest paid. Right? In other words, industry itself becomes mobile, takes the jobs to low wage, usually non-union parts of the United States, often the Old South or the Southwest, or to the Third World. We could say an awful lot more about the process of deindustrialization, but that's basically it. In Chicago, where I am, there were 55,000 jobs in a 2-mile strip along the south side in the steel industry in 1970. There are now, from that 55,000 jobs, there are now 4,500 left. Right? And that's happened all over the Midwest and Northeast. Huge displacement of the old blue-collar working class, and huge change for the way in which city economies are put together. Clearly, those cities are dynamic places. They are never static. And in fact, skipping over lots of complicated other trends that we might talk about, I think that it's clear now that a new form of normative economic life has taken over in the older cities and has grown up to replace the shrinking industrial city. Along with the shift nationally to what Daniel Bell and others refer to as the service economy. Bell estimates that by the year 2000, 10% of us will make all of the things that we need. And the other 90% of us will be engaged in service economy jobs, right? We'll be engaged in some kind of work that shuffles paper or that serves others or in some way enters into economic life in a way that does not make anything, doesn't produce anything. That 10% of us will be able to produce for all of us what it is we need.
Does that include agriculture too?
Yeah, yeah. Along with that national shift to a service economy comes a shift in cities of the same character. Seems to me that when we look at cities these days, those that have managed to bounce back from deindustrialization at all, we might think about as a sort of triple C city, where the function particularly of new downtowns economically is as a command and control and communication center. The jobs in the new sparkling downtowns of many of the Midwestern and Northeast cities are almost all now in the expanding information industries, in administration, in a variety of technologically advanced service industry kinds of jobs. All of these, virtually all of these, are jobs in which some level of higher skill is needed than the entry-level jobs of the older industrial city. But all of these are jobs that are basically expanding what we used to call very narrowly the white-collar sector. The white-collar sector has become deeper now in terms of the both the number of people and the differentiation in the wages that people are paid. In other words, you've got very poor, fairly poorly paid white-collar workers. They don't work in factories anymore. They work in those huge high-rises that are growing up in the sparkling new downtowns. Almost all of the cities have benefited from, to some degree, from a building boom which follows on this new economic set of functions. Chicago's loop really never went into decline totally, but if you if you total up the number of buildings that have gone up in just the last 8 years, it more than doubles what was done in the previous 20 years in Chicago's loop. The same thing is happening to some degree in St. Louis and Detroit. Minneapolis actually never had a decline, but they're certainly having a boom. You see it even in San Francisco and some of the West Coast cities, and you also see it in Boston and Manhattan and Philadelphia as well. Sparkling new downtowns, marking a new kind of city and a new kind of economy. In fact, I think we're just beginning to understand what this new kind of economy means. Let me say a couple of other things about it, and then we'll get into some discussion. Behind the facade of this new sparkling downtown service economy, triple C communication kind of city, we've got an increasingly interconnected global set of economic relationships that means that mobility is on the rise. Two things in particular are more mobile than they've ever been, and they're getting more mobile every day. One thing that's more mobile is capital. That is, the pure ability to invest is now global in scope. People can make decisions from downtown Chicago to invest tomorrow in Korea or in Latin America someplace. And in fact, their firm reaches out to those places already. Those decisions can also be, at the same time, decisions to close a plant that they have in Detroit or in Toledo. So that investment capacities are more mobile, that is, capital is more mobile, and you are more likely to have the kinds of crises that come up with plant closings, with virtually overnight factories shutting down that have been there for decades and decades and that have served neighborhoods and cities. The curve on the number of factories closing has simply gone up for the last 10 years. And it is not just that new technologies have made some manufacturing operations outmoded, it is that investment capital itself is more mobile, more able to be manipulated very quickly, almost overnight. A second factor of the mobility that we're just beginning to recognize in our cities is that business leadership itself is more mobile now. That is, there were a lot of things one might be able to criticize the old robber barons for in the late 19th and early 20th century. But one thing that the old robber barons were is sort of leading citizens of the town that they were robbing at the same time, whether it's the Mellons in Pittsburgh or Marshall Fields and the Potter Palmers in Chicago or the Pillsburys in the Twin Cities. Not all were robber barons, of course, but you had each city had its collection of leading business families for generation after generation committed to that city, roots that went deep into the civic life of a community that supported the major institutions, that cared about what was going on in the city. Now, there were some problems with that, but that was there anyway, and it certainly had a lot of assets to it as well. Well, that just isn't there anymore in the increasingly multinationally connected economic entities that dot our downtowns now. The family firms, the old family firms, even those that are big enough to be in the Fortune 500, have more and more been merged into multinational kinds of operations. The old family connections to those firms have more or less been severed. What we have in Chicago is a series now of managerial types moving through town for five-year stints, basically, with no particular roots in Chicago, with no particular loyalty to the town, with no particular experience or commitment to local civic life and the institutions of the city, and that has made, in fact, a huge difference to the civic life of a place like Chicago. And I think that Chicago is no different at this point, although that's the only, on this particular point, it's the only city I've studied. It seems to me that more and more our cities are occupied at the highest economic rungs by more mobile kinds of people. And that makes a difference in what can be done. That's one side of the new city. Let me just say what I think is going on the other side of the new city. It seems to me that what we've got now, as opposed to the kind of rich, at least by social and economic class, cities of the late 19th and earlier 20th centuries, the industrial cities, we are increasingly, in fact, getting a two-class urban center now, with the very wealthy, relating to the glittering new service economy downtowns. Around each of those downtowns in virtually every city I know about, there's at least one, and usually many more than that, gentrified areas where the landed gentry have returned to the downtown city, where upper middle class people who are highly professional in their training and who work in those glittering new downtowns in managerial or professional capacities have moved back in to reclaim inner city neighborhoods, often where there's older, substantial, still very potentially elegant housing available. and have occupied some neighborhoods near downtown. We've got a number of those kinds of neighborhoods in Chicago. So you've got the glittering downtown and the upper echelon professional workforce that uses that glittering downtown and works there. I think more and more up against what we're seeing as the growth of the permanent urban underclass. And the last thing I want to do today is to just talk for a minute about the economic dimensions of the urban underclass. It seems to me that the fundamental problem, and I don't, you know, I'm assuming we all know, we've all read something about the urban underclass, and therefore I'm not going to do a from the get-go kind of analysis of it. But in the terms of that I've been discussing today through the economic lens, it seems to me that the major problem is this: that there is a massive mismatch between what the economy needs in terms of a workforce and what increasing numbers of people in our cities have in terms of skills and capacities. That's the economic problem, a mismatch between available jobs and available skills. For virtually every other immigrant group to the city, a ladder existed, a ladder of opportunity, the bottom rung of which was basically a rung which was made up of unskilled or very low-skilled labor, right? And immigrant group after immigrant group stepped onto that first rung, and then onto the second and third and so forth. With the deindustrialization of our cities and the switch to the communications and control functions of our downtown, the bottom rung of that ladder has been eliminated. There's no place to step anymore for the unskilled or low-skilled worker. There's no place to start on the ladder of opportunity. There's no way that people with no skills or low skills can leap onto the ladder midway. That, it seems to me, is the fundamental difference between the underclass we're dealing with now in our cities and the economic context that surrounds it and poor people, which cities have always had, and their former status in cities. That bottom rung is gone. The door to the mainstream of urban economic life is no longer open for people at the bottom of the ladder. It seems clear to me that the major question of economic social justice in our cities today, and maybe along with the rural crisis in our nation today, is the existence of this growing, at least semi-permanent, largely black and Hispanic, largely urban underclass. In cities like Chicago and other snowbelt cities, we've got neighborhood upon neighborhood of absolutely devastated housing and social institutions. We've seen, along with the vital growth of a black middle class over the last 20 years in urban America, we have seen a separation of that black middle class from the underclass. That is, as more opportunities opened up for a segment of the black community, the segment that was able to find a lower rung on the ladder and step up as immigration to the cities happened for black folks, that class moved away from the poorest black communities, which are now separated and detached from the stable middle class that used to be part of those communities. So that you've got neighborhood upon neighborhood that is denuded institutionally, where the major pillars, for instance, of the black community in a place like Chicago that used to be rich institutionally, used to have all sorts of associations, all sorts of businesses, all sorts of churches, all sorts of voluntary associations of different kinds, where those neighborhoods now, left with mainly poor people, have none of those institutions because those institutions were primarily led by the black middle class, which has moved out, moved away. these poor neighborhoods in the older cities are not non-functional economically. They have their own sorts of functions economically. They have a vibrant underground economy that is certainly deserving of some attention, particularly if we're interested in some solutions. Part of the underground economy that exists in poor neighborhoods in cities is criminal, clearly. It has to do with drugs and prostitution and gambling and so on. But part of the underground economy is simply an economic way of life that's detached from major institutions, that is not at all dependent on banks or on retail operations outside of the neighborhood, that is highly dependent on interchange of barter among families and on interchange of labor with each other, that's very creative in poor neighborhoods, but totally, an economy totally detached from, for instance, outfits like the IRS and anybody else who might be interested. An off-the-record economy, in other words, in poor neighborhoods, has begun to grow up, not all of which is criminal. The challenge, it seems to me, is, from my point of view, and this is the last thing I'll say, and we can get into some discussion of this, is what to do about the urban underclass. And from my point of view, what one does about any social problem is to figure out where the assets are and to build on the assets. If we look at poor urban neighborhoods, as many social service professionals are trained to look at them, as collections of needs, collections of deficiencies, collections of half-empty glasses, then we see nothing but incapacitated people. It seems to me equally possible to go into neighborhoods like this and to find the capacities, to find the half-full glasses, to find the undeniable leadership qualities that are there in lots of kids that are in these neighborhoods, to find the creativity that allows survival to happen in these streets even when there are no economic institutions there, and to build those into something that reattaches itself to the mainstream economy in cities. That, in any way, it is sort of the way I've begun to think about how to deal with these questions. But there may be other, I hope, there are other notions here about how you might deal with it. It seems to me we've got a lot of questions we could raise. What does it mean for federal policy? Should national government be involved in alleviating this at all? How about local government? How about the church? Any of those kinds of areas that you might want to get into, we should talk about. But at this point, let me stop. Let me stop at having, I think, tried to outline what I think the economic problem is, and then remind you also that to me, some of the resources are involved in the political questions and the social and cultural questions that I'll be getting into later in the week. But let's just talk for a while now.
I'm sorry. I have
questions
to
or comments?
Leave and do my share of babysitting. So.
Okay. All right.
You were talking about the blue collar work is disappearing, and that replacing that will be the service industries. The service industry's pay is so low. Is that right? But as I look at it,
well, the problem,
people are going to
yeah.
move from the blue-collar jobs, which had really worked their pay up quite high, to the service industries. They're going to be going way down.
The problem with the catch-all term service industries is it's exactly that it's a catch-all. It includes everything from bank presidents, right, to the kid behind the counter at McDonald's. So you really have to begin to pick apart different sectors in the service economy. It's clear, you know, that industrial blue-collar work did get to the point where, at least in unionized sections of the country, it was very well paid. It's equally clear that most of those people who worked in those jobs are not getting into the service economy at a point where the pay is equivalent. It may be that the growing unionization of white collar work, of service industry work, will pull wage scales up to some degree over the next decade in some sectors of the service economy as well. But clearly a lot of the stuff, I mean the McDonald's of the world, that's not going to change. That's going to continue to be very low paid stuff. You know, and the people who clean our downtowns after they close down.
People that work in hospitals and in nursing homes.
What is the feeling in the black community? You mentioned the separation between those who were the leaders who have sort of moved out and have made it in a sense. Is there hostile feeling from those that have remained? Is there a split in the black community because of that? Or do they feel proud about the fact that some of their brothers and so forth have made it, you know, in terms of getting out of the ghetto, sort of thing? I mean, what's your assessment of that?
I think it's a real complicated question. I work in the black community a lot in Chicago. And that whole question has been very much on our minds given the political situation that we've had in Chicago in the last couple of years with our first black mayor elected and so on, trying to figure out what the dynamics are internally in the black community, a lot of also just having a lot of friends. I think it's very complicated and very mixed. I think that most of the black middle class, while it no longer, I mean I'm talking in very general terms here, no longer lives in close proximity to the black poor. Is very ambivalent about that reality. And for all of the reasons that the white middle class is, really, right? That they're, that contact with the poor, black, white, Latino, whatever, carries with it a set of complications for one's life, whether we're thinking about one's family or the community, which is always problematic, right? Yet clearly a sense of responsibility in black middle class communities that you don't find in white middle class communities, for instance. I mean, the poor, one another dimension seems to me of the emergence of an underclass which is basically non-white in the cities. There's lots of white poor people around, but in the older cities it's basically non-white, is that it's invisible to white people. It really is. In most of these cities, there's no reason for white folks to go anywhere near it, and they don't. and that certainly is an increasing problem. That's less possible for the black middle class to totally separate itself from the black poor. And the realities of racism are that for black middle class people, they are still black in this culture, right? And the defined distinctions that have to do with the economic class don't often get made. And so whatever problems people have in their minds about the black underclass can get easily read into black middle class people. So black middle class people don't have the choice to totally separate themselves from questions that black underclass raise.
If you were to take any one of your sets of things, the topics this week, one being economic, political, and one another being political, one being social, cultural, and so forth. If you could easily just take a situation and move it from here to here and hope and think that that was going to help, which one of those three things would it be? Would you find it most important to move the economic and then the political would fall in place and the social cultural? Or if you could move the political, would the other two move into place better? Which would that be? It seems to me it's economic.
You want to say some more about that?
Well, I'm thinking that we probably need to redefine what work, I don't know if redefine is the proper terminology, but what the work life is. For most of us, work life has started at approximately 20 years old, and we look to it to be about till 65. That's a 45-year span. And with less jobs available and more people for those less jobs, it seems to me we have to deal with the period of time and so forth that one works. And in my mind, it looks to me as though maybe we could start looking at one's life being three periods of 30 years or something mm-hmm. like that. And from 0 to 30 is the emerging part, where your youth and educational period, and then developing a way of life for yourself mm-hmm. in those 20s. And part of that has to be getting out and like coming to Holden Village and hiking to Image Lake, or do volunteer work here, or in Guatemala, or in, I don't know, someplace in some other place, or an Indian reservation.
And the state would organize that.
Another thing that I feel that we need to do, I feel that the age of from 12 to 18 is probably the most difficult age to live these days. And that those that live just beyond that, say in their early 20s, need to go back and help some of those younger people get through that period. Mm-hmm. So there's another segment of something. And to come to the point where marriages began at a later point. Caroline Kennedy just married, she's 28 years old. That would be more of a typical time to get married, that rather than 20 to 24 mm-hmm. in that area. That she has done a lot. She knows kind of where her direction is mm-hmm. by this time. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, I've known of several young people who have gotten married at a very early age, new responsibilities, capable of going on and doing something, but just couldn't because of the added responsibilities. And it really has made its mark on life. And then that the work period of life is generally somewhere between 30 and 60. Mm-hmm. And people are living longer now, so then you've got the last third that comes somewhere around 30 to 90. Mm-hmm. As you look at obituaries, it seems like more and more people are, their obituary is saying in the 80s, than sure. 12, 15 years ago was much younger, and it's going to continue to be higher.
Yeah.
If we look at that center section as 30 years mm-hmm. of work life rather than 45, that may open up some new opportunities for more people to work. Mm-hmm. Also, I've got whole others, but I'll let you respond.
Okay, it's a nice set of a different sort of lens to go at this thing. I really just a couple of quick comments back, Oscar, about a number of things you said. I have some problem with inserting government, the state, too readily into family areas.
Well, these are
less of a problem dealing with the government and state intersecting with the economic life. Mm-hmm. It does seem to me that probably the private sector economic forces that I see working on the cities are never going to touch the underclass at this point. There's just no way mm-hmm. that by itself private sector economic activity can have any but a negative effect on the growth of the underclass. And I don't see any way around some kind of federal intervention in the economic life of cities if we're going to do anything about the economics of this question. I do think, though, that it's important to think through the family dynamics that are involved in this, too. And I want to get into some of that in the social and cultural thing. Yeah. Your initial question, I agree with you that the economics are at the center of it. I just think at this point in American history that there's not much hope for attacking the question from an economic point of view head on. The hope seems to me in what could be possible politically and in the social cultural life that could affect the economic life of these neighborhoods and these older cities.
So what I was saying at the beginning, rather than be able to just grab this economic thing and move it from here to here, you'd say rather take the political thing.
I think that would be wonderful to be able to do, that would be the most central, most important thing we could possibly do, is to shift the economics of cities around so that people have gainful work. Mm-hmm. I mean, not only jobs that pay, mm-hmm. but work that has meaning. But that would be wonderful. But we can't do it.
The way to do that is to reorganizing the political life.
I would think so. I mean, that's the major kind
and that's
of
what brings,
entree we've got these days. In the United States, we have no public control over economic life, basically. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, unlike Scandinavia and lots of other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. I think that's a problem. I really do think that's a problem. Lots of people benefit from that, but I think it leaves in its wake lots of other people, too. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to find some clearly mainstream American way, but a way nonetheless to get some control over economic forces that now are simply not accountable, mm-hmm. and are able to devastate cities, for instance, and leave in their wake increasingly poor populations. And there is no public discussion of that. Right? The only criteria that go into those decisions are immediate short-term profit criteria generated by the owning folks, by the corporations that are involved in the decisions. The effects spill over onto lives all over the place. Right? But those effects are never taken into consideration when the decisions are being made. It seems to me that that's a major civic question for us to think about. How to get some kind of control to reroute economic life so that there's some kind of accountability to some sort of community. There really used to be that almost automatically when capital was not mobile, right. when it couldn't fly all over the globe mm-hmm. so quickly, mm-hmm. when managers and owners had some kind of accountability to a locality, to a city. Without that, who's to say that the costs of that corporate decision are too high for that corporate decision to be made. Right now, nobody can say that. That seems to me a problem.
I tend to agree with what you say, but I think to say that we need a political solution, is probably right. It looks like economically there's almost nothing we can do because the jobs are going to, going to the southern part of the United States, or they're going overseas, or they're being automated. But if we look at a political solution, we're looking at the U.S., I think, as a closed system. And the U.S., we have to decide, why are those jobs going overseas now, or why are they going to the South? And I think that has to do with the mismatch of skills you're saying. That there's jobs, a high-paid service industry, but the people that used to be highly paid and unskilled can't fill those jobs. And what we have in Korea, in Taiwan, in Hong Kong, in Japan, is a society that focuses on education. It's very important, they're highly skilled, and the jobs are going to those places. So that if we impose a political solution that says, we're going to give these people work, it might be the only way to solve the problem, it's certainly the only way to solve it in the short term, but I think it ignores what happens in the long term. If Japan keeps graduating 98% of its students as high school graduates, and the U.S. cities continue to graduate 50%, we're just not going to be able to compete worldwide. So I think we have to address, the education problem. Why are half the people dropping out? Why aren't they skilled for the jobs we've got? And if we don't address some of those fundamental problems, we try to put a political fix on it. Eventually, we're just going to bankrupt the whole system, and the U.S. standard of living, basically, instead of having a small underclass, the whole country will be dragged down.
Mm-hmm. that's one possible scenario. I think, I mean, the fundamental thing I think you're pointing to is the increasing irrelevance of national borders when you're thinking about economic questions, right?
Sure.
I mean, when a company can decide overnight to move overseas, what is the use of thinking not only just about city policy, but about national policy? Mm-hmm. You can't contain them.
That's right. If we try to put a national solution to it, you know, and we to put all those people in jobs or to pay all those people, you know, subsistence levels of compensation for doing something that doesn't contribute to economic value, and people in Japan and Hong Kong do not do that, you know, how can we compete? Mm-hmm. So the question, I think, fundamentally is how do we make those people productive, get them trained to do productive work, how do we get them productive? And I don't know if you have any thoughts on that or not.
No, I mean, where are the incentives to do that any place in the private economy? I don't think there are any there. I mean, it seems to me absolutely inevitable that some kind of enlarged public sector role, government role at some level, and I hope the local, more local the better, but needs to be there. I mean, for me, the ultimate irony that gets me week after week is driving down streets of devastated neighborhoods in Chicago and seeing all around me people with no work, right? No jobs, right? 60% unemployed youth hanging out on the corners, and I know they have capacities, and I'm looking on the streets and I'm seeing endless work that needs to be done. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, everything's crumbling.
Sure.
There's work for hundreds of people for years on one block here, right? Mm-hmm. And there are all these people standing there with nothing to do in the work world. That seems to me absolutely insane. There's something insane about that.
That's right.
It's also centered on the big making money, the big businesses continuing to make money, and so there's no motivation for them to look at the concerns of these communities and that this is important work. I mean, they're looking at Japan and other parts of the world now, and there's just it's meaningless to the shiny downtown city, and so.
I think that's right. These are absolutely, you know, even Marx used to have a theory about the reserve army of the unemployed that in lots of ways explained for people who were Marxists what the function of poor people was. And the function of poor people was that you always needed a certain number of unemployed people in the economy so that those who were employed didn't have to be paid all that much because they were always threatened. If you organized too much and asked for too much money, said this theory, you could always fire a bunch of people and get some more people from the unemployed, right? Well, it's clear now that not even that Marxian theory has anything to say about what we've got going on in cities now, that these are people who are absolutely detached, mm-hmm. right, from the economic, the ongoing economic life of society. And they are simply an army of the unemployed, and they're not on reserve for anything. Right? They'll never be called up to active duty in the economy, as it's now. And they are, as you say, invisible.
But let's go back to what you said. We have this army of unemployed and all this work to do.
That's right. How can we organize that to get it?
Right.
But that's just busy work without an economic base. So
there's no money to be made.
That's the problem.
That's right.
So they're not interested.
How can we organize that into a series of incentives or a series of economic activities that
you have to create that base,
yeah.
in order for them to have a reason to do this other busy work to make a habitation.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of thing would be a part of this 0 to 30 thing that I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But you still got to finance it.
Mm-hmm.
And a part of that 0 to 30 thing, it seems, and when I talked about these 12 to 18-year-olds, it seems like people set, I mean, we talk about personality being set in an individual when they're very young, the first couple of years there. And that's true, but I think second to that, and very close behind, is a personality set that comes at that age.
Sure.
From 12 to 18. And I think that there's an awful lot of money spent for things to correct the wrongs that have not, you know, that we did not take a hold and do when it needed to be done,
mm-hmm.
with young people, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as you see teenagers hanging out and so on, and just doing doing all sorts of things that are just adults tear their hair about, that we need to start developing a way of letting them grow without having these influences.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't stop that, but you sure can develop a way of getting people past that age and into their 20s without as much
teenage years or something.
For example, the prison system, it just needs to keep growing and growing, and it'll have to grow continually if we do not do something to make people understand that that's not a way of life that they want
to
live.
Right. To be continued. The bell has rung for dinner. So we've got to let people go for dinner. Okay.
Thanks, Jim.
Uh-huh. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I understand. Do you need to shut that off?
Probably. How do we do this here?
Well, it looks like I think there's a stop thing here somewhere.
There she is.